one was the issue of implementation. The other one was the issue around the alignment with the protection of private information. There were a couple of other issues. The issue of the gateway of the DNA database being in the gateway, available in the gateway of Interpol. A couple of other issues. So can we start with that before we go into the bill again, please? I know that state law advisors have indicated to me that you still need a bit more time to look at the private protection of private information. Bold. The challenge that we do have, members, is that it's still a bill. So it's very difficult to align it, given the fact that it's a bill. It's not an act yet. It hasn't gone through all the processes of Parliament yet, but we need to take cognizance of what is in there so that we can align the two pieces of legislation, even if it is referring to it in a way that we don't refer to the name of the bill necessarily, but to refer to the type of legislation. The problem is also that we can't delay our own work waiting for that process to end. When we come back, members, I just want to give you an indication, we will not be going on oversight. And it's not because it's my choice. We've been given clear instructions from the Speaker's office that if committees are busy with legislation during the committee week, there are 3 weeks coming back of committee work, that committees must prioritize legislation. And that is because we all know that we're going to have a shorter year this year. So we will, when we come back, continue with this bill. The nice thing about it is that we would have 3 full weeks of full-day meetings, so we will be able to finish it then quite fast without having to meet in the evenings and without having to ask for special meetings. Thereafter, we're going to, just after we're done with this, members, I've got bad news for you. Although I think members like the Honourable George and the Honourable Ndlovu and myself would see it as good news. We are, and I don't want to see any surprise faces from the side of the department. I've been told that the SAPS Act, the SAPS Bill, will go to Cabinet by the 23rd of July. And that immediately thereafter, we would start with the SAPS Act. You can imagine that that would be, well, we will have the 3 weeks for advertising that we will not be dealing with it, but thereafter we will deal with it. Luckily, again, the timing works out in such a way that we literally, I see no surprise faces, it's not my problem, it's your problem. I had witnesses with me when the date was confirmed with me. Thereafter, it works out in such a way that by the time the bill comes to Parliament, we will again have a short break, constituency period break. In those periods, we will then be able to advertise for public comment on it. When we come back, we will be able to deal with the public hearings because there will be a committee week again, and then we will continue with the bill, because if we don't start with that bill, then we not be able to finish that bill during this Parliament. So the sooner we get this done, the sooner we can release you to start working on the subject. We start on the 23rd of July. Sorry, don't get hysterical, I've got my dates a bit wrong. The 23rd of July we're starting, and by the 6th of August we must be done with this bill. Hopefully we will be able to do it even before then, because if we've got 3 weeks, we all know at the rate that we're working, we should be able to do it then quicker than that. Then the SAPS Act will be introduced on the 13th of August to the committee. So, members, we mustn't feel sorry for ourselves. There are other committees who are currently dealing with five pieces of legislation in front. requirement of them, so, and who needs to finish them as well. So that's the only reason why we're not going on oversight. Hopefully after the SAPS Act we still would have the time to go on the two outstanding provinces that we do have to do conduct oversight on it. Can I ask the department to be chirpy this morning and to be entertaining? And entertaining, we sat until 8:20 last night. I think we're all tired. Our bodies are sore from sitting in the chairs, and it was a question of not getting up because we were voting throughout the time for the whole 6.5 hours. So please, you've got to entertain us today so that you can keep us awake as well. Thank you very much. Over to the department.
Thank you, Chair. The State Law Advisor has asked if he can proceed firstly with the issue about the protection of privacy law. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. Yesterday, Commissioner Jacobs handed out a document which refers to the notes on the submissions made by the public on the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill. I'll be jumping a bit to page 16 of that document. Yes. It's the notes, the word document. It's not the bill, it's the word document that was, yeah. If members are ready, then I'll proceed. Thank you, Chair. The heading reads, the alignment of the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill, which is referred to as the bill, with the Protection of Personal Information Bill B9B of 2009, the PPI Bill, on page 16.
It's not the one that I showed, even though I asked him, so I'm still more awake than the State Law Advisor. This one.
Yes, that's correct.
Not the coloured one, this one that was handed out now. Yeah.
Jim, we have extra copies, if members don't have it.
SB100613 stands at the top of it. Can we just make sure that members have before we hand out to others, please? Okay, we can start. Thank you. Page?
Page 16, Chair.
16.
Actually, the Protection of Personal Information Bill is currently before the Select Committee at the moment. So the bill is not finalised as yet. In view of the instructions of the committee, we've considered the PPI Bill and the impact of it on the bill before the committee, the DNA Bill at the moment. We started off with Clause 1 of the bill, of the PPI Bill, which provides for the definitions. And we've highlighted specific definitions which relates to the scope and extent of personal information with specific reference to the DNA information and DNA profiling as contemplated in our bill. The first definition is biometrics, the term biometrics, which also includes DNA analysis. So it means a technique of personal identification that is based on physiological or behavioral characterization, including blood typing, fingerprinting, DNA analysis, retinal scanning, and voice recognition. Then there's also a definition of child, which is also refers to a natural person under the age of 18 years who is not legally competent without the assistance of a competent person to take any action or decision in respect of any matter concerning him or herself. That is also aligned with the DNA bill, which also makes reference to the DNA profiles of children. Incompetent person means any person who is legally competent to consent to any action or decision being taken in respect of any matter concerning a child. Data subject means the person to whom personal information relates. Then there's also a definition of personal information, which means information relating to identifiable, living, natural person, and where it is applicable, an identifiable existing juristic person, including but not limited to information relating to race, gender, sex, pregnancy, marital status, national, ethnic or social origin, color, sexual orientation, age, physical or mental health, well-being, disability, religion, conscience, belief, culture, language and birth of the person. B. Information relating to education or the medical, financial, criminal, or employment history of the person. C, any identifying number, symbol, email address, physical address, telephone number, location information, online identifier, or other particular assignment to the person. And D, the biometric information of the person. E, the personal opinions, views, or preferences of the person. F, correspondence sent by the person that is implicitly or explicitly of a private or confidential nature, or further correspondence that would reveal the contents of the original correspondence. G, views or opinions of another individual about the person. And H, the name of the person if it appears with other personal information relating to the person, or if disclosure of the name itself would reveal information about the person. There's another definition that is appearing on the bill. It's public body, which means any department of state or administration in the national or provincial sphere of government, or any municipality in the local sphere of government, or be any other functioning or institution when Roman I, exercising a power or performing a duty in terms of a constitution or a provincial constitution, or Roman II, exercising a public power or performing a public function in terms of any legislation. In the record, means any recorded information, A, regardless of form or medium, including any of the following, writing on any material, 2, information produced, recorded, or stored by means of any tape recorder, whether hardware or software or both, or other device, and any material subsequently derived from information so produced, recorded, or stored. 3, label, marking, or other writing that identifies or describes anything of which it forms part, or to which it is attached by means. B, 4, book, map, plan, graph, or drawing. 5, photograph, film, negative, tape, or other device in which one or more visual images are embodied, so as to be capable with or without the aid of some other equipment of being reproduced. B, in the possession or under the control of a responsible party. C, whether or not it was created by a responsible party. And D, regardless of when it came into existence. Then the definition of regulator means the information regulator established in terms of Section 39. Responsible party means a public or private party or any other person which alone or in conjunction with others determine the purpose of and means for processing of personal information. Special information means personal information as referred to in Section 26, which I'll come to later on. Our conclusion was, with respect of the definitions, the aforesaid definitions include DNA information, and DNA profiles of persons as envisaged in terms of the provisions of the bill. So those definitions which I've highlighted basically refers to the scope and extent of DNA information. In Clause 2, the PPI Bill provides that for the purpose of the Act, which includes, among others, is to give effect to the constitutional right to privacy by safeguarding personal information when processed by a responsible party, subject to justifiable limitations that are aimed at, 1, balancing the right to privacy against other rights, particularly the right of access to information, and 2, protecting important interests, including the free flow of information within the Republic and across international borders. B, to regulate the manner in which personal information may be processed by establishing conditions in harmony with international standards that prescribe the minimum threshold requirements for the lawful processing of personal information. C, provide persons with rights and remedies to protect their personal information from processing that is not in accordance with this Act. And E, to establish voluntary and compulsory measures, including the establishment of an information regulator, to ensure respect for and to promote, enforce and fulfill the rights protected by this Act. Clause 6 of the PPI Bill provides for certain inclusions from application. The relevant part of the clause reads as follows. This Act does not apply to the processing of personal information, A, in the course of a purely personal or household activity, B, that has been de-identified to the extent that it cannot be re-identified again, and C, by or on behalf of a public body, and one which involves national security, includes activities that are aimed at assisting in the identification of the financing of terrorism and related activities, defense, or public safety. Two, the purpose for which is the prevention, detection, including assistance in the identification of the proceeds of unlawful activities and the combating of money laundering activities, comma, investigation or proof of offences, the prosecution of offenders, or the execution of sentences or security measures, to the extent that adequate safeguards have been established in legislation for the protection of such information, D, by the Cabinet and its committees or the Executive Council of a province, or E, relating to judicial functions of a court referred to Section 166 of the Constitution. Our conclusion in respect of the exclusion provision, in terms of the aforesaid clause, the PPI bill will not apply to the bill insofar as adequate safeguards have been established for the processing and protection of personal information, the purpose of which is the prevention, detection, including assistance in the identification of process of unlawful activities, investigation of or proof of offences, the prosecution of offenders or the execution of sentences. Clause 12 of the PPI bill provides for the collection of personal information directly from the data subject, except as otherwise provided for in subclause 2 thereof. The relevant part of clause 12.2 in relation to personal information provides that it is not necessary to comply with subclause 1 if D, collection of information from another source is necessary, 1, to avoid prejudice to the maintenance of the law by any public body, including the prevention, detection, investigation, prosecution, and punishment of offences, 2, to comply with an obligation imposed by law or to enforce legislation concerning the collection of revenue as defined in Section 1 of the South African Revenue Service Act 1997, Act 34 of 1997. 3, for the conduct of proceedings in any court or tribunal that have commenced or are recently contemplated. 4, the interest of national security. Or 5, to maintain the legitimate interest of the responsible party or of a third party to whom the information is supplied. Clause 14 of the PPI bill provides for the retention and restriction of records. Clause 14.1 specifically provides that records of personal information must not be retained any longer than is necessary for achieving the purpose for which the information was collected, unless, amongst others, the retention of a record is required or authorized by law. Clause 14.4 also provides that a responsible party must destroy or delete a record of personal information or de-identify it as soon as reasonably practical, after responsible party is no longer authorized to retain the record in terms of subsection 1 or 2. In addition to the aforesaid, clause 19 of the PPI bill provides for the security measures on the integrity of personal information. In this regard, we are of the view that clause 19 is consistent with the proposed clause 15X of the bill, which provides for access and security in relation to information on the National Forensic DNA Database. The application of the PPI bill, as contemplated under Part C of Chapter 3, also extends to personal information of children, those are persons under the age of 18. Clause 34 provides that a responsible party may, subject to Clause 35, not process personal information concerning a child. However, Clause 35 provides for general authorization concerning personal information of children. Clause 35.2 provides for circumstances under which the provision contemplated under Clause 34 does not apply, for example, when the processing of information is carried out with the consent of a competent person. In addition thereto, Clause 35.2 and 3 provides that the regulator may impose further conditions in respect of any authorization granted to a responsible party to ensure that appropriate safeguards are put in place for the processing of personal information of children, and to establish and maintain reasonable procedures to protect the integrity and confidentiality of personal information collected from children. It's important to note that the processing of personal information of children under Part C of Chapter 3 of the PPI Bill is more fully dealt with under the processing and protection of DNA information and DNA profiling of children under the Bill, specific reference to the detection of crime, investigation of an offence, conducting of a prosecution, the identification of unidentified human remains, and missing persons. In this respect, adequate safeguards have been provided for in the bill for the protection of personal information, that is DNA information and DNA profiles of children. Chapter 5 of the PPI bill provides for the establishment and functions of the information regulator. In terms of clause 40, the powers, duties and functions of the regulator cover the following areas, namely education, monitoring and enforcement of compliance, consultation with interested parties, handling of complaints, research, codes of conduct, cross-border cooperation in the enforcement of privacy laws, and other general related functions concerning the protection of personal information. Chapter 10 of the PPI Bill deals with enforcement provisions concerning interference with the protection of the personal information of a data subject, that's in clause 73 of the Bill, in relation to that data subject in respect of A, any breach of the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information as referred to in Chapter 3, and Chapter 3 deals with the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information. In B, non-compliance with Section 22, 54, 69, 70, 71, or 72, or C, breach of the provisions of a code of conduct issued in terms of Section 60. The aforesaid chapter provides for extensive complaint and enforcement procedures relating to the interference of with the protection of personal information of a data subject. In our view, the complaint and enforcement procedure contemplated under Chapter 10 of the Bill appears to be adequate for the purposes of dealing with possible complaints in terms of the Bill in question. However, in order to ensure proper alignment with the Bill, we recommend that proposed Clause 15Y, which provides for the establishment and composition of the National Forensic Oversight Body in the Bill, should be amended, and then we propose the following clause. In addition to Clause 15Y, Subclause 12, that any complaints relating to compliance with ethical and privacy issues in terms of this Act shall be reported and processed in accordance with the complaint mechanism prescribed in terms of the Provisions of Protection of Personal Information Act. I have to say, Jefferson, in view of the status of the bill at the moment, it's not an act yet. So that might be problematic because there's no guarantee that the personal protection of personal information bill will be processed in time, that the DNA bill, which is currently before the committee, will be put in operation. So the committee would probably want to consider adding a complaints mechanism within the DNA bill to cater for the enforcement provision, because currently the oversight body only provides for monitoring function. In conclusion, we are of the view that the PPI bill is not in conflict with the provisions of the amendment bill before us. Thank you, Chair.
Very much for that. Members, there you have it. Can I see whether there are any comments, questions? Can we talk about this issue? I must just say that I do think, personally, that's my personal view, I'm more than willing to engage around this issue, but I do believe that it will be a challenge to have an oversight body in another bill referring to a criminal DNA database. And I think my view is that we should go the route that we've decided upon when we said that we want to extend the mandate of the monitoring body to also include complaints. And I think that for no other reason that there's a uniqueness around the fact that it's a criminal database. It's not only criminal, but in effect there is criminal purpose around it, and we might have difficulty in also knowing SAPs have difficulty of another department having to look at their dealing around ethics, etc., etc. It might be problematic, but we'd like to hear members on this issue and hear what you say. Honourable Quilla Barnard, Honourable Lawbo.
Thanks. If you could just perhaps guide me to the section which you referred to, I was just looking for the reference, where someone is in breach and has been found to be selling this information, for example, because I was wondering if we should not be aligning our, you know, we were mulling over up to a 15-year sentence. We didn't know, I don't know that legally we can actually remove the option of a fine. I seem to recall we had that same thought in the IPED Act, and we wanted to be very strict, and any police officer found cleaning up a crime scene for a car, we wanted to take away the option of the fine, and I believe there's some legal something that said we couldn't do that. Now, I wondered if we could, if there is a specific punishment, censure, crime, fitting the crime for selling private information in this bill, that we should, we're not more or less obliged to align the DNA bill to. Could you just lead me to the relevant section? I can't find.
I will allow to take. You won't find it because it's not in the in what they've given us. This is just an extract dealing with the alignment of the bill. But you can respond to that. Is there any honourable global, please? And then we will take the comments from the polls.
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I must thank the stage for our advisor on this. My take on this, Chairperson, is that we are talking about two bills, two separate bills, because state information bill, it's a bill that belongs to the other, to the state security cluster, and this one.
Sorry, this is not the state security bill. This is the protection of private personal information. It's a bill that comes from the Justice Committee.
Yes.
It's not the protection of state information bill.
Okay. What? Oh, no, it's fine. No. What I'm trying to say, Chairperson, this bill, the bill that we are dealing with at this moment in time, will have an impact on this other bill. Therefore, I was thinking is that the mechanism, the paragraph that you read towards the end of the presentation, if it's captured in the justice bill, is there any possibility when we finalize our bill, because we have to have a mechanism in our bill where there should be a complaint mechanism and people to report the complaints and so on and so forth, because we talk about we did discuss about secretariat in the bill and so on and so forth. Should we refer it to it, or should we put it as this paragraph appears here, or should we refer to the bill itself? Or what about if the bill does not succeed? What will happen? Because we are talking about two bills. It will be better if we are talking about the bill and the act, because it will make it simpler, because we can refer to it so and so. But now if there are two bills and we may not know what will happen, or they may amend it, whatever, then we are left in the loop on the other side. It will make us to be, it's a challenge, Chairperson. I'm trying to go along with you. It will be a very big challenge at this moment in time.
Honourable Lefete.
Thanks, Chair, very much. Let me thank the presenter on this bill. my question, if you could detail this protection, what is the mandate, if I put it correct, of the protection of personal information bill? Protect who? Against what? Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, I'll allow the state law advisor to answer that question very briefly, because it's just so that members have a better understanding of it. I also think I want to agree with the Honourable Ndlovu on this issue. I would rather see us going the route of legislating for the DNA database in one piece of legislation. Keeping in mind that we're in line with this bill in terms of the definitions of the do's and don'ts. But the fact of the matter is also, if you read clause 6 of the PPI bill that you've just gave to us, it's quite clear this act does not apply to the processing of personal information by or on behalf of a public body, and then it lists, for instance, the fighting of crime. So it would be also wrong of us to use that complaints mechanism to deal with SAPS not dealing with the DNA database correctly. So I think if I hear members correctly, the general feeling is let's go the route that we've said already during the public hearings of extending the mandate of the ethical committee, the monitoring committee, and let that also include the complaints mechanism. We can maybe look at what they have in this bill in terms of the complaint mechanism that they have and maybe align some of that so that the functions are more or less the same in terms of complaints, or the processes are more or less the same in terms of complaints. Over to you just to respond to the questions that members have raised.
Thank you, Chair. The first question with regard to the breach, in terms of the bill, in terms of clause 60, the regulator will issue codes of conduct for various industries, and any breach of that will be regarded as an offence. And in the with regard to the penalties, is various categories with regard to certain penalties, and the option of a fine or imprisonment is also applicable in this instance, because it's not just natural persons that would be involved, but also juristic persons, companies that will misuse or abuse the information that's retrieved unlawfully. And then with regard to the purpose of the protection of personal information, well, it's basically to have a legislative framework for the protection of the privacy of personal information, and it goes much further than any detail of personal information communicated by whatever means, as I discussed in the application provision of the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Legeto, it is about your personal information. Honourable Kulabana's personal information. It's also about companies selling your credit record to another company, or selling your health company selling your record to your insurance company or something like that. It's about that. So it's about protecting the individual. It's got nothing really to do about protecting state type of information. In fact, it includes, excludes where it's state fed. Okay, I think we're happy with that. What I, I think as long as we are in line in terms of the other stuff, the codes, obviously, if this bill, I don't know whether it's going also to give guidelines in terms of, you said it's going to give minimum guidelines. What did you call it now?
These codes of conduct will be issued by the regulator.
Will that also apply to the State Department?
Yes.
Now, I think simply that is like any other piece of legislation. SAPS will then have to take cognizance of that and make that part of their security of their DNA bases, etc., etc. Commissioner Jacobs?
Chair, maybe just to add to what Ms. Kulabana asked about the offence, in terms of the Prevention of Corruption Act, it is an offence for any official to sell or give for other advantage information which is protected. So I think already there is also an additional sanction that fits into this as well.
Can I ask that you give us a schedule of those offences and the penalties for it? Don't have to do it now, but give us a one page with the corruption one, the personal information one, so that we have an idea of the schedule of offences, so that we just make sure that we are in line with this bill around that. Okay, can we then continue with the other issues that you needed to report back to us?
Thank you, Chair. We already did the one on clause 1 when we started. On clause 6 of the bill, the proposed section 15G, the portfolio committee indicated that it requires to be addressed on the migration between indices and also on a full report on the issue of familial searches.
Is this, we're not on the document. They're still reporting back on the issues that we gave them last week to come back to the committee on. So it's now, that's what they're doing now. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, General Shezi has also made a presentation on a disc as well, which we can put on the slide. But unfortunately, I received it now, so I don't know if there's hard copies available as well.
Chair, the hard copies are available as well with me. The last portion on similar searches are not part of what was printed initially, but it will be on the screen if permitted.
Can you make copies of that? Is there enough copies for the members? Okay. Can you distribute that to us before we start thinking with that, please?
Thank you, Chair. The copy of the presentations that you have
includes the part also on the accreditation. I saw it was also part of what was to be reported back. But I would have requested that we showcase the part on the familiar searches so that it's available on the presentation, because the prints are not here. We didn't make the prints, unfortunately, Chair. If can they be allowed, or can I talk to the issues on the familiar searches?
Look, first of all, I want to make it clear. If the department want to make a presentation, I expect the department to be on time and to set up their presentations beforehand. The sound and vision person was here waiting for you. Can we call them back, please? It is not the responsibility of the committee secretary to make sure that your presentations are done unless you have arranged with them before the time. And I would also request that, you know, when we deal with these kinds of things, that we do so timeously. We will ask the sound and vision to come back so that they can link up one of your computers do you have a computer here that you can use? That they link up the computer to the sound and vision system. But in the meantime, continue then with what we have on the hard copy, please.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies for the inconvenience. On the hard copies, what we have is the presentation on the accreditation. If I'm allowed to just start on the accreditation, because accreditation has been coming back from a while. The committee had requested on many instances to provide the accreditation. In the copy of the presentation that is before, it is detailing all the processes that are involved to accredit the environment, so that the fund that is allocated to the whole process is also read in line with all the processes that it will be associated with. On the first slide, it talks to the forensic processes. If I can be allowed to provide also the processes that are involved for the accreditation, so that when I talk to the plan, it is in context of what it is that it is going to be accredited with, the processes involved in the forensics. The blue lines on the bottom of the point there indicates the pillars of accreditation, or the elements which must be subject to accreditation. The facilities, the instruments, the reagents, the procedures, and the personnel. For example, with the facilities, it will then imply that the facilities must be conducive for the type of operations, as we have seen during the comparison of the our laboratories with other laboratories. What are the requirements in terms of the facilities, in terms of the instrumentations? It will include the calibrations, it will include the methods that are employed with the instrumentations, with the reagents, it will include the reagents that I use during the time of the accreditation, the specific types that the processes were used to accredit to those methods that are applicable, with the procedures employed, that will also be cost or related to a specific process that must be followed, be it isolation, be it be it amplification, you will see that as we talk to the processes in the next slide, as well as personnel, how competent our personnel, how proficient our personnel registers with regulatory bodies. This is one of the other discussion that was coming up as during the debate. All the bases of the pillars that are indicated in blue, they form what is in green there, which is the FSL quality management system. The quality management system that now denounced or that explains the existence of those five pillars is in place. It has been compiled and it is implemented in the lab. What you see on top in the red, which is written there, the X51 of 77, the GLP, the ISO, so those are the governing documents. The Act prescribes how the analysis must be conducted, who must be conducting those analysis, the format in which the report must be communicated to court, that must be catered for in the quality management system of the forensics, because unlike the private laboratories, there is no Act that governs how the reporting must be done. But how the reporting is issued out in the private laboratory is only governed within the framework of the ISO standards. In this case, it is ISO 17025, and it is also reflected in the presentation. The second ray there indicates the good laboratory practices. It's just summarized as GLP there. In good laboratory practices, it implies is wearing the PPE as an example. Will you wear the same PPE in this area that you process DNA, as well as the same PPE in the next other area? What are the consequences of cross-contamination and those other issues? There are good laboratory practices also that form guidelines in how the laboratory processes must be effectively managed. The last one then will refer to other acts and standards which impact in the operations of the laboratories. For example, this will include, amongst others, the Waste Management Act. This will include Compensations of Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act. This will include all other acts, including the labor relations, in terms of how these are all incorporated within the quality management system. So the yellow part as well as the green parts, or the little gray parts that are indicated there, they show the processes of when an exhibit comes into the lab, which is the process which differentiates the laboratory, forensic laboratories, from any other laboratory in practice in the field of science, because it is in that process where a number of activities happen before a sample is subjected into a lab process. What differentiates the forensic lab, for example, is that a crime scene, a sample is collected from the crime scene, which sample is not optimal. It must first be prepared, made optimal before it is subjected to a lab process. But when we get into the laboratories that are private or privately run labs, that process is for them outside the scope of what is being carried out. So as we talk to the process, we'll see how accreditation impacts a lot on that part also of the exhibit before the lab process, as well as the end part in the reporting part in terms of the affidavit and how those are compiled in terms of reporting to court. Okay, we can go on to the next slide. The next slide talks to the evidence recovery. Now, this is the process that is followed when the sample is received in the laboratories. The sample is collected from the crime scene. I will make an example with that sample that is collected from the crime scene rather than the sample that is collected from the buccal swab. I will talk to you that one also a little later. If the sample is collected from the crime scene, it is a new case, it is registered into the case reception, and then it is captured in the what is called the case administration system. Here you will realize in this block there that there is an indication of PCAM as well as the FSL admin. In numerous instances when presentations have been made in our environment to say PCAM has been rolled out, and then we say PCAM has been rolled out in the forensic environment, in the biology environment, PCAM is fully rolled out for the phases that they were intended for. It is working as we speak, it is working quite optimally. In fact, to date we have also received, or we have already begun to pick up those cases where there are numerous duplication of bags that are procured from the companies that are supplying us with forensic evidence. Amongst others, you will note, Chair, that when the case is presented in court, it is always important that you present to the presiding officer that a case is uniquely marked, is uniquely captured, in those instances where a manufacturer provides a bag, the bag must be uniquely marked. There shouldn't be any existence of any other similar bag of that nature. But with the PKM to date, we are able to pick up at least 4 or 5 bags that were duplicated. So it could show that it is the same number of the bag that was produced, which was used in another case, which might become a problem, but we are able to track it back and see where the problem originated. So I'm only highlighting these factors to say what happens during the accreditation process. It means there are processes that must be followed at case reception. There must be a quality manual compiled. How do you look at a case to see that there was no tampering with the evidence when it comes into the laboratory? Can you see if there was tampering? Is the person trained? Are the exhibits captured and stored in the places where they are supposed to be stored for the duration of the time that they are stored? There are processes that are applicable in that process which are governed by that PKM. PKM is exhibit track and trace, as well as the FSL administration system. The FSL admin is a legacy system. It has been in the environment for very long. That system also tracks to see when was the exhibit registered or received at the lab, when was it registered, when was it transferred to the environment in which it belongs. So the first step in the accreditation process is the evidence recovery process is prioritized. The assessors will have a look at that place to see, are all the governing principles in this area taken care of? That will include the archive provisions, that will include the tampering provisions, the chain of custody provisions, the training of personnel, the administration of the system, the up-to-dateness of that system, all those, the conditions, storage conditions, the packaging conditions, all those elements will then be applicable at that element of the case reception. But what they now do when we look at the first slide, they will look at all the elements that are applicable. When we go back to the first slide, they will go on and have a look. Are you meeting as what is required from the Act, from the GLP, from ISO, from other acts that are applicable, and the facilities and the instruments, reagents, all everything that is applicable in that area will then be quantified to see the applicability of that area within that area. And then you are able to say, yes, the process conforms or it doesn't conform. If it doesn't conform, what will then happen is they will give a corrective action or suggestion to improve that process, correct it, and then the process can go forward. So, after the exhibit has been received, the next stage will be the storage process then, which is also administered by PKM. We have also realized with the utilization of PKM that at times the storage area is duplicated. The storage area will be duplicated for one case over the other one, but in terms of the chain of custody, that duplication is something that must be avoided. I'm not going to talk about the entire processes. I'm only giving the little bit of a highlight when we get to the bottom of the page where in the implementation to say all these elements will be applicable in each of the steps for the evidence recovery process. The last part of the evidence recovery process talks to the presumptive testing, that last block in blue, which will go on to the next session that says cut the sample. In this part, it is at the stage where the body fluid has already been identified from the crime scene. At times, or many times, the exhibits that come to the lab, the exhibits are not, the body fluids are not identifiable visually, so there are processes that are done to be able to identify the body fluids, even from the clothing that have been washed. So it is in that process where also the applicable system will go on. And then I would like to talk about the last part, Chair, because it's also going to impact on the last slide so that we are not going to take a little bit of time. Okay? When you look at the process where it's written cut samples, the second block of the page, that process goes on to say DNA. If yes, it's DNA, and yes, it's a semen sample, the process will go on to be an automated process. That automated process is the CI lane. Last time, the chairperson inquired about the state of readiness of the CI lane, whether the CI lane has been validated or not in the process, and how far is that validation process. The part has been completed also, and the methods in that instance have been validated. So one or two of the questions that will then be asked in the automated process, they will look at the entire system, also look into the process that has recently been employed, to see if it also it is conforming. If there is no DNA that is found, if it is no semen, if it is no blood, if it is no saliva or any other body fluid, then that exhibit is finalized, it is dispatched. In the dispatch process as well, there are dispatch conditions, what needs to happen in the dispatch in terms of the applicability of the Act in there, as well as all other areas in the environment that needs to happen within the dispatch environment. And then that portion will then be completed in terms of the evidence recovery process.
I'm going to ask you to get to the bottom of the story. We want to know how far you are. I appreciate your passion for explaining the process to us, but a lot of it is very technical. So please, just be a bit faster around every slide.
The next part is talking to the analytical process. Is the next slide. This is the slide that will talk to the two areas within the environment. The first left side of the page talks to the RI lane. Yesterday's submissions during the discussions were, amongst other things that came up, were perhaps how many of the samples could be handled by the laboratories capacity-wise. The first part, the first half of the part, will talk to those RI lanes, how many lanes are there, how many are going to be incorporated into the environment, and the processes of sampling that. If you look at this slide, you will see that there are two columns. The right column where it's written analytical process is the manual process, which manual. The buccal swabs, as they come into the lab, it's a new sample, which is casework. If there is casework, yes or no, it's no, because it's not going through the isolation process. It will go directly into the amplification process. Amongst other questions that were asked in previous literature, which you said perhaps you would want to highlight in this process to see what would be the difference in processing the buccal swabs other than the normal samples that are being processed in the lab. This is the process where that will be happening. The RI lane will be processed, the samples or the buccal swabs, or as it is defined in the bill, the non-intimate samples will go on from that question that they are no casework, and they will go directly into the amplification part. This is the part which ensures that the processes of the turnaround times are improved, and it will determine how the numbers that will go into the process of accreditation. The last part in this page talks to allele designation. That allele designation in the bottom of it has got a pointer that's written by software. This is a portion where in the previous time we were here, we were talking whether it's the coding, whether it's the source, whether it's what application system, the readiness thereof also. In the accreditation process, as all those processes are taken into consideration, this part should be the part also that is ready, that the process can go through, and then the DNA results will be generated for reporting purposes, which the reporting purpose will also have its own slides, which I'm not going to talk about. The next slide talks to the laboratory processes. In this slide, it talks to the laboratory processes that must be ready before the entire accreditation process begins. In the generic FSL documentation or the quality manual, we've got 81 processes. That is in the total process that are applicable generically in the entire FSL environment. It means when we have to accredit the DNA unit, 81 processes that are generically applied within all the disciplines of the forensics must also be ready. Because once we have the overarching principles ready, then the rest will also be taken care of. We cannot go directly and accredit the DNA unit while the overarching 16 elements prescribed in ISO are also not ready. Those 16 elements within the forensic environment are defined within 81 processes. Which 81 processes I'm not going to talk to. I'm only going to talk to the DNA one. I only wanted to highlight that as to talk to the pieces. The entire FSL processes there, as you will see, the estimates in the implementation plan will talk to the figures, which will then include the FSL quality management processes. The bottom part of this lab process slide talks to the DNA processes. It's got six processes. The first process is on the left-hand side there, it depicts the evidence recovery. In the evidence recovery, there are 10 involved processes, which include the samples that are received at the lab and the preliminary testing as well as the reporting. This is the portion that we suggest will take place last, as you will see in the plan as it is prescribed now. and then the process that will go earlier or first during the accreditation phase will be the analytical process and the profile and then admin reporting. The reason the two are going on earlier is because with the accrediting body, it will be easier to get people even in the country or even in the companies that they are associating or they are working with, people that are already ready to can do the processes in the analytical area or in the profile and admin area, because it is in those areas that are a bit common even in the public or in the private laboratories. But the evidence recovery area is specific for the forensic purposes. It then needs to be consulted outside, and that process also impacts on the costing thereof. The analytical process has got about 42 processes, and the profile and admin has got about 3 processes. This slide talks to the breakdown of the processes. Talking to the plan itself, it is the page with lots of green. It is the second last page of the documentation. In the printout that you have before you, all the elements that are indicated in white are the elements that can be confirmed with discussions or with documentation. There are source documents in the supporting background into this. One of the questions that we asked previously, I think Honorable Corona asked to say, what is the state of readiness of the laboratories accreditation-wise? The white areas are showing the areas that are completed. They will be broken down in the next slide to show the specifics in those elements. The decision has already been taken to accredit. Implementation plan and the team has already been taken place. When that question was asked, Chairperson, the quality management environment had only 8 people that were working in the component or in the division. At this stage, there's 106 people that are already employed, also part of the people that were appointed in the previous run, in the 2012-2013 areas of the appointment, what is the financial year. And this year, there are 710 people that will come through in the environment, but not all of them are coming for the quality management environment. It could perhaps be that they will also be appointed in the biology environment to also include the capacities. So what I'm only saying, in those areas where it says, is there a team, is there a plan, those are the markers that are showing that now we are getting ready to get our processes run. In the portion of the slide that is giving you to say fund projects, the elements that are in red are the elements that are not complete yet. Those are the elements that we are working on. I only wrote fund project there because the final estimates or the final costing of the product will come through when the whole map has been finalized by the accrediting body, but we have allocated the funding to 50 million rand. The 50 million rand will now cater for accreditation of the entire forensic laboratories. For the DNA unit or the biology unit, an estimated 10 million of the 50 million has been set aside for the entire process. Some of the issues, as you will see in the next slide, are issues that are anyway done by the people appointed in the environment, because people are given the requisite training to be able to do the necessary preparations and establishment of the quality management concept as they are required in the environment. So what was supposed to happen with the decision and awareness as a stage one of accreditation that has been done, it's completed. At the stage two, the documentation and the implementation, we have analyzed what is needed, we have mapped all the processes that are needed because it's part of the plan, that's complete. We have built a quality manual. The quality manual consists of 3 tier documentation. We've got policies, procedures, and forms. Those are done and those are finalized. Build the record keeping system. That is done. TCAM as one of the examples that I use there to be updating our records and our processes. Amongst others, it is TCAM. We also have other internal processes like the STR lab. We also have within us the SSL admin system, and then those are implemented. Where we are now are issues that are arranged in orange. Review documents against 17025. Following the engagements with the accrediting body, the stage where we are now with the processes that are identified is to review the documentation and this process will only conclude, Chair, around in December 2013, because it will be aligned with all those processes as they were indicated on the first page. The next part that will follow up after the review of documentation is the closing of gaps. What will then happen is that the SANAS will get this documentation, and then they will provide for us what it is that we need to close as gaps or the corrective action. This is the process that we assume or we expect that it will be complete by March 2014. And then the facility arrangements, the storage and the maintenance part of it, it is a process that we are engaging with the Department of Public Works, amongst others, the Division of Supply Chain Management to assist with our facility management. We intend that the update will then happen by December 2014. The accreditation process, it is what will be indicated then on the next slide. But referred to the last part, as we have indicated there in the map, how long will it take after we have had all this process to finalize? It's about 6 to 10 months following that those processes already concluded, and by May 2015, that process will be completed. And the second last slide, it talks to the decision and the awareness. In terms of that has already been mapped out, and all those processes towards the accreditation process are now in there with their time frames as they are outlined. And the next process, or the very last page number 9, talks to that process that will close the gaps, because it is in that process where we anticipate that there will be a lot of engagement, a longer period of time, and what must happen before or all the other processes that need to be completed, which will have to be within these time frames. The process itself, after all the steps have been highlighted, when the SANAS has indicated that after all those gaps that have been identified have been closed, these are the estimated periods which are anticipated to be followed for the accreditation process, beginning from the 3 weeks of the reviews, as well as the review of the quality manual specifically, and the report to staff by the lead auditors as appointed, and the corrective measures that are given for about 6 months. The entire process will then extend until May 2015. This is what is in the presentation, Chair, in terms of the plan of the accreditation.
Previously, you have it. Any questions for clarity on Wakula Barnard, Honourable Mulawasi?
Just, and I was listening to the accreditation plan and the 6 months. Do you have a date on which you will actually put through your application for accreditation to the relevant international body? I mean, is there a date we're working towards that we can hold you to account for? And if you give us a date and we say, have you now put it through on that date and you haven't, now we'll want to know why. Please, just give us a time frame in specifically in relation to that, and do you know, once an application goes through, how long does that application take to process? What procedures have to be gone through? Thank you.
Honourable Mulawasi.
Thanks, Chairperson. You, in your input, you said, unlike the private labs, you don't have a format of reporting. So why is it like that? And then you even mentioned this reagents and procedures. Am I right to say reagents are methods and procedures are how you are going to implement the methods? Thanks, Chair.
Honourable George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your evidence recovery, you talked about avoiding duplication when you talk about storage. Can you tell me how does duplication arise, and how do you think you can avoid this duplication? The other thing, you are those areas where you're talking 2015, how is that going to impact on the bill, if waived? If that part is similar to about this whole thing involves IT equipment, is this thing we are presenting also includes the cost of IT would use for this? If yes, how much would be, how much, because I didn't see the cost. Is that cost, is that budgeted?
Can I ask you to be short and precise in your responses, please? Start. I see we've got visitors in the gallery. Welcome. See, they are some school children, and I presume it's teachers with them as well. I don't know. Welcome. You are attending the Police Portfolio Committee, and we are busy looking at legislation that deals with DNA. Now, I'm not going to try and explain to you what DNA is. I still struggle, but I'm sure you've got clever teachers up there that can tell you what it is. We're going to use this DNA to help us catch criminals, but also to help us to find children that gets lost, and when we have natural disasters, to identify people. You're welcome to the meeting.
Thank you, Chair. The first question was a question from Honourable Gaza. When is the anticipated date of the application for accreditation? The anticipated date, according to the plan, is November 2013. By that time, the gaps that have been identified, we anticipate that the shed have been closed, November 2018. Question number two was talking to the format of reporting. Honorable Mandevati was asking, why is there a difference in the reporting to the court purposes? In terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, it is prescribed in Section 212 what needs to be the contents of the reporting to a person who is in the service of the state in performing the examination. While in the private laboratories, they report solely based on what the format of the reporting is per ISO standards. So in our instance, we try to balance the two so that we don't lose out also on what standards prescribe, I mean on the standards prescribed, but particularly what the court requests. The third question was, are the reagents methods and their procedures, the manner in which they are implemented? The reagents are actually the consumables themselves that are used in the processes. For example, water is an example of a reagent that is used. It's all those stock solutions that are applicable within the processes to isolate the DNA. So it is kit, every other chemicals or ingredients that are used. All those are called the reagents. The procedures are how to conduct an analysis or how to package exhibits. It is included in those two. Honourable Mbuleleki asked about the evidence recovery and the duplication process. It's the duplication of bags. The question was, how can we avoid the duplication of bags? What we have given the inputs, we have compiled a tender, or can I call it a contract, which stipulates what should be in the bags, that the bags may not repeat itself, the serial numbers must be unique for the bag, what type of material that is used. So that the bags are not manufactured within the forensic and laboratories, but they are procured from the company that gets them the contract. So it is the responsibility of the company to ensure that all those duplications are not taking place, are avoided. So the company must also be accredited according to the field in which they practice. So the best we can say that we avoid duplication is to do the scanning. That's one of the parts of the requirements of the PKM, to be able to identify the bag. So there are procedures that when the person is delivered in the lab, when it is scanned through, already it will tell whether the bag is duplicated or not. So that it is not received, it is repackaged according to the requirements. The accreditation dates, the other question of how will they impact on the bill. Accreditation is not a legal requirement in our country. It is good practice within the technical environment. We are accredited so that there is technical confidence that the laboratory is expected to function within the same expertise as with the rest of the people that are doing the same processes, but it is not a legal requirement. So therefore, there may not necessarily be any implication as such what you are required to do is to have the quality management system which is run in many other countries that are, we have visited or we have seen. Accreditation is not a requirement in law. It is a practice that is applied in a technical expertise. But those are laboratories that are not accredited must have a quality system. Otherwise, there is no confidence that you can generate to the court to say you follow the process that can be audited and assessed to that that your results are generated with confidence. But we have taken a commitment to accredit our laboratories in the country. IT costs. The last question was: are the costs of IT also included the accreditation processes and the independent process from operations? Accreditation is done as you conduct your analysis. Where IT is involved, they will accredit the process with the IT that is applicable at the time. If there is no IT, there is no IT that they will accredit the process. So what they find, they assess, is it in line with what has to happen, and then the accreditation happens. But it is assessing the practice as they are conducted, as they are documented within the process. Thanks, Jeff.
You said yesterday, Commissioner Shelley has been sitting here far too long. She's becoming like a politician.
Yeah.
I heard your question about the cost. And I know that's still not given. I also heard the Honourable Mulabati's question about, Kulavanat, who asked, once you've put in the accreditation, how long is it going to take, the request for accreditation? How long will that process take? Members, can I indicate... our first meeting when we come back is going to be a meeting. We said we're going to call IJS and TFM back. The first meeting that we have when we come back on the 23rd will be that meeting, where we will talk about the implementation. Do you remember we told them to go back and plan better and come back to clear answers? That will be the first meeting. And then we want to have these cost breakdown in detail as well. That also includes Commissioner Shelley, 24th July, sorry, Bongal was just correcting me. We will have that in detail, but then we want the costing done properly as well. And that includes whatever outstanding costing there is in terms of accreditation towards the process of accreditation, but specifically to the introduction of this bill, the implementation of this bill. I want to make it clear, you still need to continue, but I'm not going to allow this much time. Get to the bottom of what we've asked. Talking the jargon to us is not assisting us. You can get on to the next presentation, but get to the bottom of the question. Get to the answer, please. Okay, continue, so that we can finish it. We still want to start in interacting with the ball today as well.
Chair, the question was reflected in the content, I think it's page 9. It was asked when the submission has been made and the date, how long it will take. The breakdown is reflected in there. For each of the stages, if I can refer the honourable members to page number 9 of the application in there. So each process will have 3 weeks. I just didn't calculate how many of these weeks now will take. It's 6. We can just be given some few minutes to do that. 2 months. Chair, this relates to almost a year for accrediting the entire process from the submissions that are made in page 1. 3 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 months, 1 month, 3 months, and the 2 weeks at the bottom. If the all else within this time frame is specified.
That's fine. Let's continue, please, with the rest of your presentation so that we can move on, please.
The rest of the presentation then includes the familiar searches. The one question that was asked in the previous week was the familiar searches, what the familiar searches are. Brigadier Malawzi, if you can go directly to slide number 10, please. I'm just going to read what the familiar searches are from the presentation at the front of the chair. Familiar searches is a technique whereby a crime scene profile is deliberately run through the database in the hopes of getting a list of profiles that are genetically similar to the DNA evidence in at hand and using this information as an investigative lead to interview family members of the near matches. Just in simpler terms, it is a crime scene sample that is received from the crime scene. It is then run in the databases that exist in the sub. All the alleles that are similar will then be grouped together so that the family member can be traced. Let's go to the next one so that it becomes easier, as Chair says. The algorithm for the comparative search must be set to a low stringency search with the intention of identifying a relative of a perpetrator. And the PTSA, Chair, I really can't afford the sound jargon, but I will have to either explain it. Otherwise, it becomes difficult to speak in any other language in terms of doing the searches, unfortunately. It's likely to result in the parent-offspring relationships where a siblings and avuncular relationships are less likely to result. The technique that is utilized in the lab is using a kit that will test 16 loci. This will be the new kit that will be used for the for the background sample. It means it identifies 16 areas of the DNA where it is different from individual to individual. But within a family, a brother, a sister, of the same mother and the same father, you will find that out of the 16 loci, 10 of them are common. 6 will be different. So 10 out of 16 will be common from one brother and sister and so forth. So if it does happen that my brother, in the DNA database as an example, as a volunteer, my 16 loci profile is uploaded on the database and the crime sample is found in the crime scene, it is typed and it is loaded to the database because they can't find anyone to whom the sample belongs. That sample will be run against the database check. If it happens that the 10, more than 10 out of 16 are found, all those people whose profiles or whose loci will be 10 are found in the database are now collected together, and then the interview sessions with those family members or their relatives will then begin to happen. That's what it means there. But then with the algorithm for comparative session, then it means when that software that the chairperson is asking about, which is going to be discussed when TMS is here, when it is set up, it has to have provisions for the searches that are below the algorithm to search a specific value range to be able to determine whether there is a likelihood of that kind of a search or not. But at the moment, we don't have that algorithm set up in the manner that it is requested there. But if it is a case, then we say that familiar searches can be done. It means updating the software to include that algorithm. And then the paragraph 2 and 3 then will say that it then depends on how many of those people are generated by the computer with that missing and matching. The next slide, please, which is almost up. Okay. It says there, additional analysis is necessary to verify relatedness between the evidence profile and the partially matched offender. One of the questions in this discussion that came up in the previous discussion, Chair, was whether it is the same as a partial match. Now, there is familiar search, there is a partial match, it is not the same thing. In partial matches, it is the instance where a crime sample was found at the scene, but because the sample has degraded or was not enough, you only found 10 areas of the DNA and not the 16. But the 10 is associated with the suspect or the perpetrator at hand. The computer then will attach a statistical value to either link or exclude the person. But it is not a search similar to the one which is conducted when you do the relations or the biosurveillance. Okay, then it says there that then special software will be used to calculate the likelihood ratios, which will then differ from the current likelihood ratios that you do. What is the likelihood ratio? It's the question that the courts normally ask. What are the chances that in the whole population there can be another person of the same profile? That is what the talking about. The last part then talks to the detectives. If we then generate out of the generated comparative searches, one, let's assume by default, 100 of the people are found to can be relatives of the samples of the crime scene, then the investigator who will look into this must surely be trained. It will also be included that in their training they've got to be understanding the familial searches as well. So in the part of the presentation of the familial searches, it is only showing if you go that route, these are the needs that also must be considered. If you do not go this route, what are the current statuses at the moment? But this, I hope, it addressed in short the familial searches. Thanks.
Many questions, Kulabonat?
Thank you, Chair. I'm looking, and I recall that there was some consternation when we were overseas. There was some group who were very much against familial searching, saying it was some kind of human rights abuse. But on the other hand, the police were telling us that they've solved many crimes through using familial searching. Is there some way we can look at fingerprint usage? For example, you find three sets of fingerprints at a crime scene. You pull some and let's say one is an identified on your criminal database. You go to that house and there are other people there. Do you now feel one may take their fingerprints in that they are becoming, they're obviously connected with a gang or with a criminal unit of sorts? So in other words, is this already used by SAPS as an entity to try and pin down unidentified fingerprints at a crime scene, known, linked other persons who may not yet have been convicted of a crime but seem to be part of a gang or part of a criminal group of some sort? Because that would in some way mitigate against complaints of using DNA in exactly the same way. Because we could then say that we've been doing this as a source of tracking down further suspects for years. So I think that may assist us if someone can fill us in what the current status is in that regard. Thank you.
Honourable Ndlovu, Honourable Mulubansi.
How does it work, familiarization and triplets? The people, the children who are born around about 3 or 5. At the same time, how does it work? Is the DNA the same or is it different? I'm asking this question because if they are triplets or they are five, something like that, with a good mother, by the way, it can end up that you are arresting a wrong person or a wrong brother. When is the sister involved? Something like that. I'm trying to be clear on that because on the familiar session, we are trying to find a suspect. We haven't yet found a suspect, but we are saying this can help us to come nearer to that person who is involved in this thing. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. In an event, the victim has been burned to ashes. What is it that is going to be detected? Thanks.
Response from the department.
Thank you, Chair. The first question goes with the use of fingerprints in comparative searches of the fingerprints on the ACES database. We are not currently doing the comparative searches on the latent print on the database to run it against maybe let me answer it in two ways so that it is more practical. What is it?
I obviously didn't mean putting a fingerprint. You can't match any fingerprint. I'm saying you've identified one fingerprint at the scene as someone who has committed a crime previously. It's on your criminal database. There are other fingerprints. Can you go to this person's house, take fingerprints of people in his gang or his house, and compare them to the unidentified prints at the crime scene? That is what I'm trying to establish.
Commissioner Jacobs?
Chair, I think what is clear from the legislation, both the fingerprint as well as the DNA legislation, that you can only take a fingerprint or DNA if there's a reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed or if the person has been arrested. The only exception is that one where there's a group involved. And that specific, I think with group it is meant there, some persons who were present simultaneously in a building when something happened. And not just a like a group of a gang. I think that we're pulling it a bit wide. And I think the legislation is clear that without a reasonable suspicion, we have set out that in this bill relating to DNA, you would need a warrant in any event just to take the DNA if there's a group involved.
Continue, please. Wrap up now, please.
The children bond, Honorable Lobo, you asked if what is the case of the triplets or the quadruplets. It will depend whether they are fraternal twins or they are identical twins. What does it mean? It does happen that one egg and one sperm, what is it, breaks or forms when the process of the twins is making it is a formation from the combination of the same genetic makeup. It means it's sourced from the same egg as well as the same sperm, which then divided to have either two or three or four or five children. So it means if any one person of the five are identical twins, then it can be with the DNA technology as either linked, mislinked to the wrong one, or any of the five, as long as they are of the same gender. Because they will be of the same gender anyway because they are identical twins. When it comes to fraternal twins, it is when it is the twins that are of not of the same sperm, not of the same egg, but they are conceived at the same time. So you will find in fraternal twins there is a boy child and there is a girl child. Those boy child and the girl child have got a different combination of genetics. So when you map their profile, it will be different because they are from the different egg and a different sperm, different egg and a different sperm. So the question after having explained that if it is identical twins, you may link a wrong person, then circumstantial evidence will kick in. If it is fraternal twins, then the DNA is different than in that process that we can be able to come. The last question was the burnt ashes in terms of finding the profiles from the burnt ashes. If having done the DNA from the ashes that are burnt, the best DNA that works at the moment for in that circumstances is mitochondrial DNA. It's not nucleic DNA. It is that DNA which works better for familiars. It means it is not coming from the nucleus. It is an easier type which relates, which works better with the families or the maternal aspects of the DNA. So in that instance, if we do find the DNA, but it is mitochondrial, it is not the same kit, it is not the same loci, it is not the same profile, it won't be running the database for the nucleic DNA, it is a different setup that will happen. If for any reason that we could be able to generate some DNA evidence with the current markers that we use for this purpose, then it will also be run in the similar fashion because we will be able to find the matching profile.
Now the next issue was the issue of the gateway, am I right?
Chair, yes, there was also a question about the migration between the indices. And Chair, what I want to propose is that the Interpol part we can actually deal with when we deal with that section relating to international cooperation, or as the committee wish if we want to deal with it separately.
We can deal with it when we get there, but I want to make sure that we don't miss it as well. So if members can also remind me when we get there, please, that we actually deal with it then. Can we then go back to the, am I correct, we're now going back to the bill?
I'm not sure, the committee indicated that they would wish to hear something from General Shezi about the migration between the indices, and then we can go on to the bill, Chair, too.
The question was, Commissioner Shezi last week, was you've now got a suspect's database. Suspect is now then found guilty, and the migration between your suspect database to your convicted criminal database, or from your volunteer database to another, or the suspect is found not guilty, your migration around these issues. Can we get a clarity of how it's going to work in the bill, and if it's sufficient in terms of security around?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it will be sufficient in terms of the security, but it, like the Chairperson said in the previous presentation, which would also come up in the TMS version, this is an IT system where if we get a notification that this person is now convicted, this process must be engaged on, then it will be an automated process with the rules and other algorithms set up for that particular purpose. In our view and in our applications, I do not foresee that there may be a problem. It will only become a problem once the system solution is not ready yet by the time the implementation of the bill is passed. That is perhaps critical to find the time frames of that application.
Well, we know it's not going to be ready. We've been told that already it's not going to be ready. We know it's not going to be ready. So now the question arises again. It's not going to be ready. So how do you deal with it then? Does it then become a manual issue?
Because of that, the Chair is correct, it will then become a manual issue. But like the Chair has already pointed out later, what will then happen in terms of the manual reporting? How will the submission to the environment happen in manually from the court for the information to reach the authorized officer for that process to take place? So it might mean the time frame that's prescribed in the bill may have to be reviewed, or it may also be placed on the transitional arrangement until that process is finalized. But yes, it will be a manual process.
Because I think we do need to apply our minds when we get to this. And rather than be lax in terms of time frames, I think we need to be more tightened in terms of time frames. Also from Justice's point of Justice's responsibility in terms of informing SAPS about convictions, etc., etc. In any case, I mean, surely your investigating officers should also know what happened to his case. So I don't quite understand why we have this blame game going around. But we'll get to it when we get there. Yeah, but even currently with the manual system, I think it's becoming an easy blame game. I had a debate with one of Honourable Kula Barnard's colleagues yesterday about whose fault is it when it's not a successful conviction. Justice says it's the police's fault. The police will tell you that the prosecutor didn't do their work properly. It becomes a blame game. And I think we need, knowing that, and knowing the human nature, need to legislate for that. If it means there's a certain, within a certain time, a fair and reasonable time, that the department must be informed about convictions, then we need to put it there. But be tight about it. Don't leave it open for this interpretation and blame game as well. We will do that. That's why we have another...
If the IT system is not working, then you must know that if you are going to do it manually, the car can drop down from here to Worcester, and then what do you, well, who do you blame? Nobody. Something like that.
But even that, Honourable Ndlovu, with all due respect, even if you don't have an IT system where you, with press of a button, can see this as being the conviction, surely you don't have to do it manually. There's emails. There are all kinds of ways to communicate between departments. And that's what frustrates me about these excuses that we're getting from all sides. Okay, can I find our tea? Will you check for us? Because I think we need a break. I know members are really sitting in those benches is extremely uncomfortable, and members are quite stiff. Well, it's been changed. Yeah. It's 20 past 9, if that makes a difference. No, they're done with this, and we want to go to the act, that's what, the bill itself. That's why I want to find out, because if tea is ready, we can rather break now and then come back and deal with the bill. So I just want to find out from them whether it's ready. Why is it going out the long way? Whether tea is ready. Wait. Nompalele, don't you just want to have a look for me, please, whether tea is ready? Can I ask, instead of us starting with the ball now, don't you want to talk to us about the gateway, that we understand what is this currently, so that we can finish this and then we can carry on with the ball when we come back?
Thank you, Chair. I received feedback from the forensic laboratories on the document that we have presented. This one notes on some submissions made. Yeah.
Can I ask you, Ms., the first one, this one, is not that one, it's this one. I'm marking now A and B. Yeah, notes on submissions. Okay, carry on, please.
Thank you, Chair. I will continue, and I'm sure General Shezi might want to add with this. It's on page 4, clause 6 of the bill, in proposed section 15M. On the South African Police Service Act. Chair, there was one of the presentations that said that the South African Police Service has put the South African DNA database on the Interpol gateway, and the Portfolio Committee wanted to know whether this is indeed the position, and if so, what the relevance is then of the proposed section 15N of the bill relating to foreign and international law enforcement agencies. Chair, policy provides that we participate and only routinely load forensic DNA profiles derived from crime samples onto the Interpol DNA gateway. A total number of South African DNA profiles have been stored in the Interpol DNA database, in total 10,311, of which were 10,308 crime scene profiles, as well as 3 missing person profiles. Chair, the reference profiles that were indeed loaded on the 2004 on the Interpol DNA gateway, also alluded to by forensic DNA consultants in their submission, were expunged from the Interpol DNA gateway. I believe it was not like recently, it was some time ago. I don't have the date, Chair. South Africa benefits from the Interpol DNA gateway as our forensic DNA profiles derived from the crime scenes or missing persons is daily searched against all forensic DNA profiles loaded by other Interpol countries on the DNA gateway. And in order to ensure that there's a proper regulatory framework for exchange of forensic DNA profiles, the bill specifically addressed the issue that that's proposed in section 15N.
Questions, members? Honourable Kulabana?
If you could just clarify for me, our policy provides we participate and only routinely load forensic DNA profiles. Is this all our DNA profiles or requested DNA profiles? So just clarify for me, please.
Chair, those are only...
Any other questions? I also have two questions. I want to know when this was... expand. If you don't have the date now, you must give us the date. Secondly, you say it is daily run against the DNA profiles on Interpol, other countries' DNA profiles. By whom? Who's running it?
Okay, Jay, it is done by Interpol because the crime scene samples are placed on the Interpol database. So it's run on a daily basis by Interpol against the existing samples that they or profiles that they do have. Chair, on the date of expungement from the Interpol database, I will come to you just when we break now. If General Shezi can't help, I will make a phone call and I will establish that.
Can you help?
The date. Well, we'll confirm the date, Chair. I can't confirm it clearly now. We will find it during the break.
And the question of Honourable Kulabana, is it you load it from time to time on request?
Chair, no, it is as we receive crime scene prints, because it might be that the person comes from a neighbouring country, etc. But it's only crime scene prints, not crime scene samples, and not other samples. Let me rather say the profile of the sample that's loaded on the DNA database, or if there's a person with the same profile that's on the DNA database, that person can be traced. Because it's one of the options that we need to look at.
How many countries in the gateway? How often do you expand?
Chair, I must say that all of them have do put their DNA crime samples on Interpol, but it is promoted. But I can't really give an answer on that. If need be, we can try and find that out as well.
How often is it expensed?
Chair, I believe that whilst a crime is not being solved, that the crime sample should remain there, because there's a possibility of a hit as you continue. But as I agree that if the crime has been solved, that it should actually then be removed.
So we can accept with that logic that the 10,308 cases have been solved because it's been expunged.
Chair, I must be clear that there was a broader the database was broader, and then it was corrected. I think that is the reference profiles that were indeed loaded in 2004 onto the gateway, also alluded to by the forensic DNA consultants in their submission to the portfolio committee, were expunged from the Interpol DNA gateway.
That's the problem. It's those unsaid things that become the problem. If it happened once, it can happen again, and then we are in trouble about it. It's a different story loading a criminal profile on there, crime scene profile. But loading our total DNA database on there, even if it was, as you put it, corrected afterwards, it's not acceptable. Honourable George, Honourable Molobatse.
You asked a question about how many countries. I don't know whether he did answer that question. But I was also going to ask, what is the relationship between the diplomatic relations and this Interpol relations?
Yes. Mine is, do countries have a choice to say we don't want our DNA loaded, or is it compulsory? Because I hear you saying some.
Commissioner Jacobs, you can respond to those. Then Commissioner Sherry, I saw your hand as well, and then I want to close this so that we can break.
Chair, in relation to diplomatic relations, I must say that police cooperation sometimes I think is better than diplomatic relations. You can imagine, I don't want to mention countries, but there might even be countries that's not sort of internationally recognized. But once a criminal is hiding there, or we need information, there is cooperation between the countries in order to try and solve a crime. Regarding the DNA loaded, I think that the loading of the DNA is basically, as I said, on in the process of trying and solve that crime which is outstanding. And I think all we need to check is that to make sure that once the crime has been solved, that profile is then removed from the Interpol database.
Commissioner Sherry.
Thank you, Chair. The last question from Honourable Molevati, is it compulsory to load the DNA profile or not? It is not compulsory to load the DNA profile from the Interpol gateway. It is the decisions within the country. The one question that was asked also by Honourable Goza on the routineness of loading the samples. At the time that the samples were loaded in 2024, it was at the time that the DNA gateway was piloted at Interpol. So they requested the member countries, which we were also amongst those, to load in samples in the database. At the time, the 10,000 samples that were loaded from that premise. But the chairperson is correct to say what are the dynamics or what are the rules of engagement in terms of the loading. It is now current that the samples that are loaded on the Interpol gateway are only crime scene stains that of unsolved crimes, which are processed into the Interpol DNA gateway. If those samples must be expunged, they will be determined by the outcome of our bail currently to say these are the expungement conditions of the samples, then they will be expunged.
like at the time those were loaded in there because there was no provision for them. They've been loaded there also indefinitely. The crimes and stains of unsolved crimes. There are no reference symbols to that effect, but it's something that is now contained in the 15N, which we'll have to relook into. The one question of the how many countries, we will also confirm how many countries are in the Interpol, because it's also not all countries that have the DNA database that also participate in this process.
Maybe it's clear we'll have to apply our mind when we get to that section and be clear about it, because again, for me, it's this issue of what are we getting out of it. I would also be, I think it would be interesting to find out from you if you can get us that data, it doesn't have to be today. How many of those cases were solved because of the fact it was on zero? I think we need to know, Commissioner Jacobs, how many countries, as was asked, and who are they? Which countries are actually on the DNA gateway of Interpol? That normally also gives you an indication of the seriousness and whether it again is your smaller countries complying and your bigger countries using. So if we can get that as well, so that we can get clarity around that issue. And I think the date when this was expanded, we need to get that as well. Doesn't have to be today, but please make sure that we do get that. Members, we're breaking for tea to 11 o'clock. Quarter past 11, we're back.